This season is sponsored by Starboard. Starboard has a long history of innovation across the water sports industry and is still led by the creator of the brand, Sven Rasmussen. Starboard started in 1994 by revolutionizing the design of windsurf boards. It then got behind stand-up paddleboarding in a huge way in the early days, and it continues to improve and innovate their board design and their paddles for all abilities, while leading on minimizing the environmental impact on the planet. You can find out more about Starboard through their website, which is linked to in the show notes. Welcome to the SUPFM podcast with me, Simon Hutchinson. Every week, I chat with interesting people from the SUP world or to people who can help us, the paddlers of the SUP tribe, to improve and to maximise our own experiences and our love of both the sport and the water. Every episode is designed to inspire or to help you get a deeper immersion into the sport through my conversations with leading athletes, scientists, explorers, TED speakers, and New York Times best-selling authors. And not forgetting some of the many insanely inspiring distance paddlers we've routinely had on the show. In this bonus episode, I got to speak to the incredible Cal Major. Cal's got some stellar SUP achievements under her belt to talk about, including being the first person to paddleboard from Land's End to John O'Groats. But her most recent achievement is her epic new series, Scotland Ocean Nation, showing the beauty of the wildlife, the ocean, and the people she encountered on an 800-mile paddle around the coast of Scotland. And this new series and her other stunning films about her adventures are free to watch online, and the links to watch them are in the show notes. The biggest compliment you can give us here at the SUPFM podcast is to share this episode with any of your paddle buddies who haven't yet discovered the show. And if you wanted to catch new episodes as they come out, you can subscribe on your podcast provider of choice on our new YouTube channel, or by signing up to our newsletter, which you can do by going to supfmpodcast.com/list. So whether you're a paddleboarder or if you just love the ocean, I hope you'll enjoy this episode where it was a great honour to chat with adventurer and TV personality Cal Major. So I'm delighted to welcome back to the show a previous guest who has done a huge amount over many years to connect people with and spread love of the water, and also to raise the profile of SUP as a means to explore and appreciate the marine environment. Hi, Cal. Welcome back to SUP FM.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, I know that even by your own extreme standards, you've had a really busy couple of years recently, and I'm imagining that that hasn't really let up in 2023. So really appreciate you coming back on for a chat. And you've recently released a truly spectacular 3-episode series on STV, which is available to stream for free, and it's called Scotland Ocean Nation. And I think it's available to stream until the end of March 2024. And it is the most fantastic watch. I mean, you must be very delighted with how it's turned out.
Oh, thank you. To be honest, until the last few weeks, I felt quite... it's been really hard to watch because we've spent 2 years editing these films. James, my partner, and I, we spent 2 years editing them, and we know them like the back of our hand. And it's really hard when you've been so involved in a project to be able to step back and look at it with any kind of objectivity. But the response is brilliant, and I'm really grateful to everybody who's watched it and commented and sent messages and what have you. And people seem to be really, really connecting with the messages. And that's the main thing. You know, yes, it's a beautiful series and there are some amazing shots, and James has done the most incredible job of capturing all the wildlife and the Scottish coastline, but it's the interviews and the chats and the messages and the kind of events that happen along the way that bring those messages to life that we really wanted to get across to people. And that seems to be getting through. So I am absolutely delighted with that. Honestly, it's been such a long journey getting to this point, and to be able to finally share them with people is a real joy. So it's, yeah, a relief.
It's phenomenal. And I contacted you rather poorly timed, actually. I think it was a couple of days before you were due to actually set out on there. So you politely declined the opportunity to speak. And I can't say I really blame you, bearing in mind what was ahead of you. But you can certainly see that the care and the time that's been put in, particularly in the edit, because there isn't a sort of air second in it, really. But it's perfectly timed. But so at a surface level, it gives viewers the experience of paddling with you around the coast of Scotland. So that's 800 miles, which is every bit as beautiful and spectacular and also as challenging as you'd expect. But it's, as you say, also about you connecting with the ocean, the wildlife and the water community. And it records your interactions during the entire journey. And I don't know how you've done it, but you deal with the issues and some fairly gritty issues that face the marine environment. But what comes across is an overwhelming optimism about what anyone can do in order to make a contribution and a positive difference. And I came out of watching the series feeling personally very uplifted, and if anything, even more connected to the water, which I guess that's mission accomplished as far as you're concerned. But I also learned a huge amount during the course of the series.
Oh, brilliant. I'm honestly so glad to hear that, because that's basically ticked all of the boxes of what we wanted to achieve, to take people on a journey. It's the whole reason for doing this expedition, was to be able to take people on a journey, to engage them in the ocean in a way that isn't just standing on the shore and speaking to camera, like actually take them with us, show people what's out of sight and out of mind, go diving, get underwater, see what's there, inspire them to maybe understand their own connection to the sea, even if they don't spend much time there. And then, yeah, teach people about what's there, what's out of sight, out of mind, because that's one of the things that I was so shocked about when I was learning everything that's going on in Scottish and in UK waters, was how shocking a lot of that is, but also how unknown a lot of that is. The conversations that I'd have with people and even myself, I had no idea that a lot of this stuff was going on and that a lot of this wildlife was there and the issues and the intricacies and the nuances. So we just kind of wanted to get a really engaging way of talking to people about that, and a way that didn't shame anybody or didn't, make people feel hopeless and that there's nothing that they could do, but hopefully helped people to see that there's loads that we can all do and that we've all got a connection to the sea, even if we don't spend time there. And that there is hope, there is optimism, there are awesome people doing amazing things to help protect our seas, and we can be a part of those communities as well. So I'm really glad that you took all of that from watching the series, because that makes all of our hard work worth it when that's the reaction that people have. And we really hope that as well, as much as reaching the paddling community, the water community, we really wanted to kind of reach outside of our echo chambers and talk to people who might not otherwise want to necessarily spend time learning about marine conservation, but maybe through an adventure they might take something away from that. So that was definitely the motivation behind it.
I want to go into the episodes in a bit more detail a bit later on. But before we do, I just wanted to cover a bit of your sort of backstory, your background, your water origins, and just sort of explore that with you. So I know that you're a surfer, you're a free diver, you're a scuba diver. At what stage did you first discover SUP?
Not until a long time after I discovered diving and surfing. So 2014 was my first foray on a SUP, and I'd seen it a few times before. I see people, pootling about on SUPs before then, but not really thought anything of it, and definitely didn't think that it would become such a huge part of my life. But I lived with a group of guys down in Plymouth, and they were always out paddleboarding, like, you got to give it a go. And so finally one day they got me on a paddleboard, and that was it. Honestly, that was it. It was that first initial experience, and then the opportunity and the kind of ideas that came with that. This is a way that I can go and explore the coast. This is how I can explore further afield and have adventures. And it all just stemmed from there, really. So me wanting to help connect other people to the water all came from that initial love of being on the water myself and how that felt, and all the kind of the way it opened my eyes to the marine environment and to our seas and the creatures in it.
Excellent. And I know, or I've heard a rumour that you've got a boat, or you've picked up a boat, and you're looking at exploring that element of access to the seas. Is that true?
That is true. So I've been thinking, what do I do after paddling around Scotland? Scotland's my favourite country in the world. This paddling around Scotland was always on my horizon as an incredibly difficult challenge, you know, the ultimate paddleboarding challenge, because some of the paddles are so committing, the weather is so changeable, there's so few get out points. It's just a really gnarly place to paddle, really, and an incredible place to paddle. So I'd always really, really wanted to kind of to do that. But then I was, kind of thinking, well, what's next? I was thinking, well, I want to go to St Kilda. There's this, incredible rock stack miles and miles and miles off the west coast of Scotland. And I was trying to kind of look at maps and charts and think, how could I paddleboard there? And all these different places further afield. And then it became, global, like, where can I explore next? Like, where are the stories that need to be told? What's happening? Who are the people there that, we need to bring the stories to life? And I just kind of decided, I kind of had in my mind that I would really love to learn to sail. I'd love to learn to sail. I'd love to be able to explore further afield, be out on a boat, take my boards with me, surfboards, paddleboards, the whole lot, free diving kit, everything, and be able to go and really explore the sea and really bring the magic of the ocean a bit further afield to people back at home through our films. And that was kind of the longer term plan. But it required me to learn to sail and save up enough money to buy a boat. So it was quite a long-term plan. And then while we were paddling around Scotland, we met a chap who's become a very, very firm friend of ours called Nick, who actually met in episode one of the film, the very end of episode one. And I was telling him about my dream to learn to sail and one day, have a boat that I can get out and explore the ocean on and hopefully as well take other people out on as well. Next time I saw him, he said, I've got a boat on a mooring. Would you like it? And wow. I thought, this has got to be a joke. Like this can't be real. This is everything that, like, this dream. And it was such a strong dream in my mind. It was such a, this is the next thing. Like, this is what I need to be doing. And it's really interesting. Sorry, I will come back to the boat in a second, but all of my expeditions that I've had, like, after I've done an expedition, I'll have a period of time where I'm a bit like, just cracking on with the admin and the work and my other stuff and everything. And then there'll come a moment when I'm like, that's what I want to do. And it's been the same for every single expedition I've done. And it was like that with the boat. It's like, that's what's next. I really, really want to learn to sail and save up and get a boat and for that to be the next big chapter of my life. And so for Nick to basically say, would you like my boat, was just, it felt so unbelievably right. And Nick is unfortunately unable to sail his boat anymore. He used to live on the boat with his wife and his dog, and it just wasn't right for him anymore. And I think he felt quite unsettled that the boat was just sitting at a mooring without anything happening to it. And so for him as well, it was like a release of that pressure of what to do with his boat, knowing that it was coming to James and I. We can bring her back to life and take people out on the sea and show people the wonders of the ocean. So yes, I have a boat. Not quite sure how to sail it just yet, but I'm getting there. She needs quite a bit of work, so she's on dry dock at the minute, but that's the plan for the year, is to get her back on the water and where she belongs, on the west coast of Scotland. And then maybe one day we'll go a bit further afield with her, but at the minute definitely Scotland.
Oh, that's so exciting, isn't it? And, just exploring the coastline, obviously, that are shown off so well, in your episodes. It's, it's an area of the country which I love. So just going back to the backstory a bit, I guess you've always had an affinity for animals based on your career as a veterinary surgeon, but I know that you became particularly dialed into the marine environment from a visit to the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. Yeah. How did you find yourself out there, and just tell us about what made such an impression on you?
I was out there on my gap year, Which I still struggle to say that saying gap year. There was that thing a while ago, wasn't there? Yeah, so that's my gap year. Before I went to uni, so I had to take a year out to apply for uni. And the first half of the year I worked on a dairy farm and did various bits and bobs of work with animals. And then for the second half of my gap year, I decided to travel abroad with a friend of mine, and we went to Australia. And I was surfing quite a bit and getting in the water quite a bit. And at that point in time, so I didn't grow up by the coast. I grew up in Warrington, which is between Manchester and Liverpool. So about as far from the coast as, not quite as far from the coast you can get, but I wasn't coastal. Mm. But, you know, just loved going to the beach anytime I could, going down to Wales to surf. And I just found being in Australia the most incredible lifestyle, connecting with the sea, being in the sea all the time. And I was up on the East Coast and there was an opportunity to learn to scuba dive. And my mum and dad were already scuba divers. They're way adventurous. They're really, they're still scuba diving in their 60s. You know, they're out every weekend scuba diving in the UK. They're amazing. But they encouraged me to get my open water course. And it was like someone had flicked a switch. It was like, oh my goodness, there's an entire world down here. That first experience of breathing under the water and seeing what was down there, I was just completely in awe. And I'm struggling to find the words to describe it, because it was like being on a different planet. There was so much life and all the colors and just the animals and the creatures and everything down there was just completely mind-blowing for me. And I just became obsessed and dived as much as I could, snorkeled, scuba'd, free dive. While I was at uni up in Edinburgh, I joined the scuba diving club up there. I was surfing and diving every weekend and just really, really got my teeth into what was underwater. And actually, while I was at uni as well, I had a real interest in marine conservation through my veterinary studies, and spent a lot of time. You have to do loads of work experience when you're studying to be a vet, and did a lot of that in wildlife conservation and marine conservation. So it just became this thing that felt like a real part of who I was. The more and more I learned about it, the more awed I was by it, the more I cared about it, and the more I wanted to look after it. And especially the more I heard about how it's being threatened, the more determined I became to look after it. And then the kind of journey I'm on now is trying to connect more people to the ocean has stemmed from that understanding that actually a lot of people don't have a connection to the sea because it's out of sight and out of mind. So yeah, scuba diving was definitely a big moment for me, learning to scuba dive. Yeah.
And then we've talked about your experience of SUP, and I think your first sizable SUP expedition was around the coast of Cornwall in 2016.
Yeah,
and I don't think I've heard you talk about that. Just tell us about that first trip, and did it follow the sort of self-supported approach that you've followed ever since?
So a trip around Cornwall was a total baptism of fire. I was, you know, 18 months into supping, really keen on it, loved being out on my paddleboard. I was living in Devon and Cornwall. I was locuming as a vet all around Devon and Cornwall, and just thought this is going to be a great way to talk to people about the marine litter on our beaches, because I was doing lots of beach cleans, working with Surfers Against Sewage. I thought I can get to all the remote coves, show what's there, and hopefully encourage people to care a little bit about plastic pollution. Yeah, like I say, it was a total baptism of fire. I didn't really understand how to work out when the tides were going to be going in certain directions. I knew about wind forecasting, but quickly learned my limits. I was doing that with a friend of mine, a really good friend of mine. We paddled together and he came along with me, and that was just wonderful to have him there. But it was a massive learning curve, and, you know, we were paddling out through 6-foot waves on beaches because we hadn't thought to paddling in and out of harbours, and, you know, learning about kit bags and camping, and, you know, I'd expected it to be flat, calm and sunny and glassy and, you know, surrounded by dolphins every day. And actually it was, you know, fog and gale force winds and chased by seals at one point. Like, it was really eye-opening and quite humbling at times. There were a couple of times when I really got into trouble, and it was quite humbling in terms of understanding the need to really carefully plan and consider and to be aware of your limitations as a paddleboarder on the ocean, because, you know, as strong as you are, and I was really, really, like, really strong-willed and bloody-minded and like, I can do whatever I want. But it was quite humbling in terms of realizing that you can be as strong as you like, but the ocean is always stronger than you.
Exactly.
So, yeah, definitely a learning curve.
Yeah, I guess it's something that's quite familiar to new paddleboarders, because obviously we've had a huge influx of people into the sport. And I think my Google alerts feed was full of people being rescued by the RNLI because of an offshore wind. So I think there's a big sort of safety thing, and I've got a little section on that later on, so you won't sort of go into that. But I know you've done a lot of work with the WSA and so on, and all of that safety stuff is sort of woven into your three episodes as well. So then you had an expedition on the west coast of Scotland. It's an area which I love, particularly the Isle of Skye. I've spent a lot of time up on in the north of the island, sort of around about Dunvegan and so on, and Neist Point, which is, you know, must be fantastic. I haven't seen that from a SUP, but it must be quite intimidating. But there must have been quite some planning involved in there. And I think you did it on your own, unsupported as well, didn't you?
Yeah, so that one was a complete change of plan after day one, actually. So the original plan was for me to paddle around the island, and my friend was going to run around the island with her dog, and they were going to meet me every night. Her dog was called Skye as well. they were going to meet me every night. We'd camp together, we'd eat together. She'd resupply when we needed to, but we'd spend the days apart and then meet up in the evenings. And Skye, the dog, decided after about half an hour that she wasn't up for it, and just lay down and said no more. So I carried on my own. So basically just my friend headed off, she went home, and I carried on my own. I'm really, in some ways, I found it so empowering to do an expedition on my own, because there were so many incidences when, you know, if you'd have told me before I got on the water what would happen that day, I wouldn't have got on the water. I would have said, I can't do that. I'm not strong enough. I'm not fit enough. I don't have enough, you know, mental resilience, or, oh, that sounds horrendous, I don't want to do that. And yet I did manage to do it, and so it was really, really empowering, and it really showed me what I was capable of. And amongst the really challenging moments, you know, Skye's a windy place, really windy, and there are some mega currents around Neist Point, around Dunvegan, in fact. You know, you're paddling through the Minch, which is an enormous tidal race between Skye and the Outer Hebrides. It's a very challenging place to paddle, and yet amongst all of that difficulty and that challenge, there was so much beauty and so much spaciousness and so much space and so much opportunity to really feel like I was a part of nature. And that's the first time really I felt that, was that experience on the Isle of Skye. More so even than, you know, scuba diving on the Great Barrier Reef, I felt that real strong connection to where I was and to the ocean and to the seals there and the birds and the eagles that were flying overhead. And it was an incredibly special experience and very formative. And, you know, I had terrible, like, nutrition and food choices with me. I survived one day on rock cakes. I survived another day on Tunnock's tea cakes, like things that now would be an absolute no-go. But, you know, then I was young and a bit more able to survive on less calories. And
well, it probably didn't touch the sides, did it?
No,
calories you're expending.
Yeah. It was a really wonderful experience. Like, you know, I wild camped every night with this terrible camping kit and, you know, hiked up hills to fill up my water bottles. And it was a real, real adventure. And it just felt like I was a part of that wild place. And that felt really special. And I was, again, documenting the plastic I was finding as well. But from a more kind of personal level, I think to this day that experience was my most formative. It was just, it was so special.
And didn't you meet James involved in that project? Because the film that came out of it, but and you needed some help, I think,
yeah,
shooting it and going back and
found a
budding young filmmaker.
Yeah, so we have a mutual friend who basically set us up. So she contacted him and said, they were away hiking somewhere. And she said, oh, my friend's doing this. And he said, that sounds cool. Does she need someone to take photos? And anyway, basically at the end of the trip, I almost actually went home. I'd finished the trip and I was really exhausted and I was just ready to go home to my bed. And James, I'd finished a couple of days earlier than I'd planned. So James wasn't planning to come up for a couple of days. And I nearly sacked it off and said, I don't need photos. I just want to go home. But I thought, no, I'll just wait. He was really interested in helping out with the project, with teaching people about marine litter and what have you. And anyway, he came up and we met up, and my parents were there at that point in time. They'd come to meet me at the very end of the trip. So he met my parents the same day he met me, and he still wasn't put off. And we made this film together about paddling around Skye. We're just friends for a while for a good few months. That was 6 years ago this year, and we've been together as a couple really since a few months after that. And we've had our fair share of testing moments working together on this kind of thing, because
I'm sure
I didn't realize how hard it was for him to see me go through stuff like paddling around places. So I met James, and James then made the Isle of Skye film Vitamin C, which is about paddling from Land's End to John O'Groats, and also the series Scotland Ocean Nation.
Yeah, fantastic job he's done on all
Absolutely.
Of those.
Yeah.
One of the things that stood out about the Skye film is that you would assume that in these very isolated places, these very isolated beaches, they would be pure and unspoiled and so on. But what you showed is that their isolation actually is a huge problem, because seaborne plastic waste is everywhere these days. And if it's not likely to be seen by humans, it's not likely to be cleared. And it was quite a shocking amount of waste that you came across.
Yeah, and I was shocked. And, you know, I was a marine litter campaigner, and I was shocked at what I found. You've hit the nail on the head. You expect this wild place with these wild beaches, which you cannot get to by land. They're only accessible by sea, to be untouched. And they were the worst affected because there's no one there to pick it up. And, you know, one day I found a cow who'd swallowed a part of a fishing net, and there were stories from, I met a farmer who said that she'd had to have several of her cows operated on. They grazed down to the waterline. She had to have several operated on to remove plastic from their rumen because it was such an issue from swallowing plastic. So it was very eye-opening. You know, this is the one of the remotest, some of the remotest places you can get in the UK that I was paddling to, and no less affected by plastic. And a real mixture of what I was finding, plastic bottles, fishing gear, massive pipes from fish farms. And that's the same up the whole of the west coast of Scotland. It's just, you know, you could go to almost any beach and find that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but pretty horrendous. And just to cover off some of your other greatest hits, and probably the biggest one, I guess, in terms of distance, which is becoming the first person to cover the distance between Land's End to John O'Groats in 2018 by paddleboard. I mean, that was an epic trip. And as you said, that's shown in the film Vitamin C. And by the way, we'll link to all of these films in the show notes. They're available via YouTube. And I definitely recommend you catch both Skies to the Limit and Vitamin C, and obviously your new STV. And we'll give you all the details in the show notes. But at the time you did that Land's End to John O'Groats, there were two women attempting the route. There's yourself and Fiona Quinn. And that was a very serious manifestation of girl power going on right there. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts about sort of the strong female representation and participation within SUP, because I can't think of many sports where there've been so many really strong female role models across all flavours of the sport, really leading it and pushing the boundaries.
I'm really glad you asked that question, actually. So, my first expedition paddling around Cornwall, I I knew that it could be done because two blokes had done it a few weeks before, and not one part of me at that point thought, it's been done by guys, but could it be done by a woman? It just, I was really, you know, bloody-minded about things, very stubborn, but I didn't at any point in time think, I need to consider the fact that I'm a woman here. And I remember so clearly sitting on the beach at Wembley, about to set off to paddle around Cornwall, and Marie Buchanan coming down to see me off, and being so unbelievably inspired by her. She was such a huge help, support, and inspiration to me getting off that beach and getting going. Because, like I said, I'd only been paddling for 18 months. There was so much I didn't know. There's so much about nutrition, about technique, about distances, about speed, about, there was so much I didn't know that I was about to learn. And to have Marie there to teach me, reassure me, and support me was such a huge help. And you know, she's still a friend today, and I still feel very inspired by her every time I see her put up a picture of her paddling on the south coast in either beautiful or terribly gnarly conditions. But you're right, like this is a community that has some incredible female people, women paddlers, and you know, not women paddlers. They're just, I think it's just a wonderful community, a wonderful supportive community. I feel really grateful for how supportive it is. And, you know, I've met a lot of people through this community, people like, you know, Joe Mosley, who's now also a good friend. And there are some real badasses doing really cool things in this community.
They certainly are. I mean, a couple of weekends ago I was at Sub 12. Emily Evans just absolutely bossed it relentlessly round the course, and she's, you know, a tiny thing, but she just absolutely nailed it on what is just it got quite difficult in some, you know, at some moments on the course there down in Torquay. So yeah, and Marie Buchanan, if you can possibly help to persuade her to come onto the show, I'm not sure whether appearing on a podcast is her favourite thing, but I've got all my other targets like Bart de Zwart and Chris Burtish and obviously yourself, and I just need to get Marie Buchanan on. So if you can put in a word for me, that'd be greatly appreciated. She's an absolute legend.
She is a legend, and I don't think she is quite aware of how inspiring she is to people, just by being herself, just by doing her thing, and by bossing it. I will see what I can do.
Fantastic, thank you. That's wonderful. That's much appreciated. Okay, so in any other episode, we'd be spending a significant amount of time talking about Land's End to John O'Groats. You know, it's one of life's sort of great defining journeys. But I did want to spend a bit of time talking about your series, which we've obviously already trailed up front. So it's Scotland, Ocean Nation, and it's definitely a must watch for any paddleboarder of whatever experience level for all sorts of reasons. And it's about your 800-mile journey. You start in Glasgow, up the Clyde, then into the open ocean, up the Wild West Coast, and then around Cape Wrath, and then back down the East Coast, ending in Bournemouth. Try not to say Bournemouth, because that's where I am. Bournemouth is completely different. It's Scotland's first harbour down there. So, yeah. So how would you sort of encapsulate the series? How would you describe it if you were, say, doing a bit of an elevator pitch?
So the series is, it's about that adventure, but it's about, it's official tagline, it's a journey of discovery, an epic journey of discovery. And the whole point of it was to show people what's out of sight and out of mind through this journey of this adventure, through the people that we meet, through the wildlife. It's there to celebrate our seas. It's there to really celebrate what we have in our ocean, you know, right here in the UK, why it's worth protecting, what's going on under the water, and how we connect to the sea and why that's important. So I paddled around that coast. I started in Glasgow because that's where COP26 was happening later in the year. I'd already paddled around the Dumfries and Galloway coast as far as that when I did Land's End to John O'Groats. So I was thinking, how can I make this relevant to this year? So paddling down the Clyde, I wanted to show people that actually even Scotland's biggest city is connected to the ocean by this massive river, the Clyde. And along the way, I met Scotland's ocean people, fishermen, conservationists, artists, groups of kids, water users, surf therapy groups. And the whole point was to see how people find a connection to the sea, what the sea means to them. And then along the way, we just let happen what happened, and some unbelievable things happened, both good things and bad things. We experienced the most epic parts of Scotland's coastline. Again, good epic and bad epic. Yeah. We experienced Scotland's most incredible wildlife. Good epic, and again, terrible experiences with Scotland's wildlife. And by taking it on as an adventure, I hope that it would capture people's imaginations and bring more people into the story and bring more people into the conversations that we wanted to have, which was about what is actually happening on our seas, on our doorstep, what's happening in terms of biodiversity, climate change, in terms of all the wildlife there, in terms of the people there, and what is actually underwater, what's out of sight and out of mind, and what can we do to further connect to our seas? Why should we connect to our seas? And what can we do to look after them? So that elevator was a very long elevator.
Wasn't it? It's probably Empire State.
Elevator.
Yeah,
sorry,
maybe
get
2 miles an hour. No, that was brilliant. You certainly encapsulated that. And we'll go into some of those topics in a bit more detail, because there's some really fantastic stories to tell there. But I'm sort of contractually obliged as the presenter of SUP FM to go into a bit of SUP nerdery before we enter the substantial discussion. So first of all, I observe that the board you're on, it looks remarkably similar to some of the boards that you've previously used on other trips. Is it the same board that you've been using?
Exactly the same. It's the same board that I used to paddle around the Isle of Skye, Land's End to John O'Groats, and then all the way around Scotland. Yeah.
Okay, so my follow-up question for you then, Cal, is how on earth is it still intact, bearing in mind the number of harbours and rocky beach landings you've had to do? I mean, it still looks absolutely immaculate.
Yeah, just a very, very well-made board. So it's the... Am I allowed to talk about the board a little bit?
Well, we're sponsored by Starboard, so yes, absolutely.
So it's a Starboard touring board, PineTech, 12 foot 6 by 29 and a half inches, sorry. And honestly, that board feels like an extension of me now. Whenever I get on it, it just feels like it's a part of me. I did smash it up on some rocks accidentally when I was doing the jog and had to gaffer tape it together for a few hundred miles. It's had a couple of dodgy repairs with Solares. Apart from that, it is in phenomenal condition. My dad and I actually revarnished the top of the board last summer, but it's still going strong. It's an absolutely brilliant board. And the fact that it is still standing after thousands and thousands and thousands of miles and, 7 years of being really, really heavily used. I only started using it in 2017. 6 years of being really heavily used is testament to how well those boards are made. And I've actually just started paddling the same type of board, so a Starboard touring board, but a 14 foot by 28 inches. So watch the space on that one, because that's the kind of I'm using that board at the minute and seeing how that feels, hopefully a little bit speedier and more streamlined. But I have honestly nothing but praise to sing for that, for their touring boards. Really feels like you could just go forever with them. Really amazing.
They are quality, aren't they?
Yeah.
And just on the sort of nerdery, so obviously you journeyed round Cape Wrath, and I don't call it Cape Wrath because it's sunshine and lollipops. I mean, it's all sort of properly gnarly. But one of the first points that you made at the start of the first episode, and actually woven within all the other episodes, is the sheer amount of time that you spent learning about, experiencing the tides and conditions and behaviour of water. So all of your experience that you've accumulated. And also it shows you several times calling the Coast Guard, letting them know where you are. You know, I mean, basically that, and you talk about exit points or the lack of exit points, escape points. So, you know, safety is woven kind of seamlessly throughout the episode. And it's pretty much a case study, you know, if you pick out the right bits of how to organise an expedition. I mean, was the inclusion of those points a deliberate approach? Because I think some adventure shows do tend to sort of hide or leave out some of the preparation and the thinking.
Yeah, it was definitely deliberate. And there's a little piece to camera. It's only about 3 minutes long, but in the first episode, where we were editing the first episode and we were seeing, you know, massive drone shots of me 5 miles offshore on the way to an island, or, you know, in enormous choppy seas. And I actually sat down with James. I said, we need to do a piece to camera where I talk about safety, because I do not want anybody thinking this looks like a piece of cake. I'm going to get on my paddleboard in the centre of Glasgow and paddle over to Arran without knowing what they were doing. And, you know, like I've said already on, you know, in the last half an hour, I started from being really, really clueless about, you know, about what paddleboarding was, and have built up this knowledge to get to this point over years and years and years. And I really just wanted to hammer home that that was the case, that this is possible to do, and it's great fun, and it's brilliant, and it's empowering, and it's wonderful, but only if it's done safely. And you can't mitigate for everything, but there's so much that you can mitigate for. So yes, we definitely wanted to wind safety into the narrative from the get-go. And, you know, whenever we went on the water, we were checking forecasts, we were planning, we were, this is why I couldn't speak to you, unfortunately, while we were paddling, because every spare second was forecasts, was calling the Coast Guard, was making sure that we were going to be safe. So, yeah, there's a lot of logistics that goes on behind the scenes. And, you know, we could have done 3 one-hour episodes just on the logistics of how to take on a trip like this. But that got a bit boring after a while. So,
And as I've said probably lots of times, it's a beautiful piece of filmmaking. And if you are listening and planning an adventure of any length, or just want to enjoy the film from your armchair, there's a real feeling that we're actually there doing it alongside you, which comes across really clearly. But obviously there are other messages in there as well. Life is another co-star in there. All of your very significant encounters with wildlife, and as you said, some positive and some rather upsetting ones. Yeah. And one of the things that I wanted to start asking you about was your encounter with an orca group, where they got a little close for comfort, and it seems that at the same time, it was both the best and probably the most frightening part of the trip. Just tell us a bit about that experience.
Yeah, too right. Definitely hit the nail on the head there. So I was paddling. It was one morning, quite early morning. I think we got on the water at 5 or 6 or something. Quite choppy water. It was a bit foggy. It wasn't a nice day for paddling, and I was absolutely exhausted. You know, the day before, I'd broken down on my paddleboard and cried because I was so tired. And we had just one day left of possible paddling before a big storm came in and we were going to be off the water for a few days. So James and I, we were umming and ahhing for ages. Should I just rest? Do I just need to take some time off? I was really knackered, like I say, just weeping, tired. Because we knew we were going to be off the water for a while, and we kind of looked at the logistics. We were coming quite close to Cape Wrath. So we'd looked at the logistics of, if we stop here, we're then going to be another 10 miles away from Cape Wrath. Whereas if we paddle an extra 10 miles this morning, then when we get a weather window, we might just be able to nip around Cape Wrath. So anyway, we decided just to get on the water and just battle through it. We knew it wasn't going to be a very nice paddle. And I'm so glad we did. At the time, I maybe wasn't. But you know, a few miles from finishing, I was really wrecked. I was on my knees, just, oh, God, just got to do three more miles. And then I heard this big kind of behind me, And I thought, instant thought was, as dolphins. And my instant thought was, the dolphins have come to give me a boost. Like, you know, I can manage the last 3 miles now. And I looked around and I was like, oh God. I didn't say, oh God, I said something much worse. But there was a fin, which was 6 foot tall, so taller than me standing on the board, massive black fin, and then another massive black fin, and then a slightly smaller black fin. And they were really close. At this point, they were you know, less than a paddleboard's distance away from me. And then they were basically two bulls and one female. And the males were three times length of my board. We're talking 30 feet, six, 10 meters the males can grow up to. They were absolutely huge. I couldn't fathom how big they were, and they just kind of swam around me, and the female swam up to me. So orcas live in matriarchal society, so the females are the big bosses.
Yeah.
She swam up to me, swam underneath my paddleboard, turned on the side and looked up at me, and I was just looking down at this orca, like just locking eyes as orca. My reaction was so uncool. So someone had said to me before I set off that, you know, you know you might see orca on the west coast. I was like, yeah, whatever. But also, if I did see an orca, I wouldn't be bothered, because there are no incidences of orca attacking humans in the wild, so they're not a threat to humans. And then when there's an enormous orca underneath your paddleboard and they're so big and you're this tiny human on this tiny paddleboard, it's a very different experience. So I completely and utterly lost it. It definitely made the last 3 miles of paddling back to shore very interesting. And at the time, it was just this crazy, like really visceral reaction of just, I couldn't control myself. I was shaking, I was crying, I was screaming. I'm pretty sure I scared them off just screaming so loudly. And then afterwards, it was like, oh my goodness, did that actually just happen? That is one of the biggest privileges of my life, to have been that close to an orca, and for them to have come and investigated me and to have obviously deemed me unthreatening, or you know, just another part of their environment, felt like such a privilege and such a kind of a nod from them. So and I got back to land and just about managed to stop crying, and then James kind of turned to me and he goes, hey Carl, an orca knows you exist. And I was like, oh, orca knows I exist. Definitely, for me, the most, just the most incredible part of the whole expedition was that.
And your presence of mind, despite the fact that you had all of that fight or flight and huge dump of adrenaline there, to actually sort of record the experience pretty much immediately afterwards. How on earth did you even think about that?
Because so James was about 100 meters away, and he was in a kayak. He was paddling with me at that point in time. And he said he turned round and I'd screamed at him, James Orca, and he thought I'd said James Porpoise, and he'd be like, oh God, she gets so excited about anything. And he'd turned round and seen this massive fin that was bigger than me, and so he paddled back as fast as he could to me because he wanted to get them on film, because that's his like, he is so laser focused. He put his drone up in the air, you know, he didn't manage to capture them on the drone, but I knew after it happened, I was like, oh God, James is never going to forgive me for not having got this. So as the orca were leaving, I got my phone out of my pocket and was like, at least I can get it on my iPhone. Hands were shaking, pressed record, put the phone up and like videoed them swimming away, and thought, okay, at least I've got them swimming away. And then later realized that I'd pressed photo and not video, and got a photo of my feet. So I thought the least I can do is get my reaction. And honestly, the whole trip, we were so laser focused on capturing everything. It was such a huge part of what we were doing, that every day was a lot of filming, both on the water, off the water, cutaways, interviews, like everything was film. So, it was always at the kind of forefront of my mind, really.
Yeah. So obviously that's the headline, the biggest apex predator out there. But there were some much smaller, equally remarkable creatures. I mean, flame shells, you know, were absolutely beautiful little creatures.
Oh,
but they craft their own environment a bit at a time, don't they? Just tell us a bit about those.
I'm so glad you brought up flame shells. So this was another species I didn't really know much about. And then when I heard about them, I was like, people need to know about these. They're so cool. So flame shells are these, I like a paper I read once that called them an iron brew coloured mollusk, which I just absolutely love because they're just wonderful. So they're basically like a bivalve, so like a almost like a clam, but they have these incredible orange tentacles, iron brew coloured tentacles, and they live on the seabed. In lots of places around Scotland, particularly in the Clyde, or they used to until the habitat was so severely degraded. But they create these amazing reefs with their tentacles. They all lock together and create these biogenic reefs, which are basically living reefs. So we have living reefs on the seabed in Scotland. How cool is that? That's just amazing. And I really just think if more people were to see what's actually there, they might care a bit more about protecting it, because oftentimes we just look out at the sea and see this like black, dark, cold looking vast body of water, and you can't imagine that there are these cool little flame shells underwater. So I'm really glad you picked up on them because they are such a cool species.
Yeah, iron brew coloured seems particularly suitable, doesn't it? And you wouldn't expect something that colour to be in the Scottish waters, you know.
Yeah. I mean,
it really is quite beautiful. So just coming back to the other sort of wildlife encounters, you know, the orca was a particular highlight, but there were some pretty upsetting experiences that you had, particularly coming from entanglement. And there were some pretty bullet examples that you came across during your journey. One of which you were able to help with, but in terms of the gannet who you rescued from an entanglement, there was a really nasty follow-up to it. But just explain a bit about, I mean, obviously the key one is the whale that you came across, but just tell us about your experience with the gannet that you were able to help.
So we were paddling around Troop Head, which is Scotland's biggest gannet colony on the mainland. So just an amazing place. Again, amazing place that I'm so glad we could show people, because you're paddling along and there are just thousands, in fact, of gannets just flying overhead, like spirits or something. It's an incredible place to be. I always thought it felt a bit like that scene in Harry Potter when all the dementors are swirling overhead, except with like good dementors, because they're gannets and they're beautiful and incredible and massive. So there were all these gannets swirling overhead, and I was like, this is the best day ever. And I was paddling with my friend Cheesy from Palm Equipment. He was there with me on the day, and we were having the best day. And then we saw this thing on a rock, and I paddled closer, and it was flapping, and instantly my heart started just beating, and it was a gannet that was basically stuck on this rock. And paddled over, jumped onto the rock, and it became entangled in like a monofilament fishing line, which had big barbed hooks on it that had unfortunately got themselves stuck in its tail and in its legs. And then one of the hooks had hooked itself onto a bit of rock, so the poor thing was completely stuck. I mean, in some ways, good that it had been stuck there on the rock, because it meant that it couldn't fly off and drown or whatever. Because there's a massive lead weight on it as well. But basically climbed onto the rock and took my time to disentangle this beautiful big bird. And it had some not insignificant injuries, but injuries that I figured it would survive from. So it had some damage to its tail and to its feet, but stuff that it should be able to recover from on its own. So released the bird, let it just left it to it. And it was a mixture of feeling really grateful to have come across it so that I could do something about it. It felt, you know, I'm a vet. I've worked with animals for decades. To be able to actually do something physically positive to help an animal was really, it felt good, but it also felt devastating that I had to, that was a thing. I kind of saw lots of gannets in that colony which were affected by entanglement and by marine litter. And it was really quite heartbreaking because they are the most beautiful bird. And it was really kind of heartbreaking to see how how we humans had affected them. And it's not always through carelessness or negligence, but at the end of the day, it is humans doing. So that was quite a harrowing moment. And then do you want me to talk about the whale as well?
Yeah, if you could.
So the whale was actually a few weeks earlier than the gannet. The gannet was kind of the final straw for me. I was so upset after having found the whale that finding the gannet as well and all the other gannets that were affected by fishing equipment was really just kind of, yeah, I was just so devastated by it. But I found we were paddling along on the northeast coast and we saw something floating on the horizon, paddled over to it, and, you know, within 300 meters of it, I kind of got the feeling I knew what it was. It absolutely stank and there was this oily film on the water, and we got closer to it and it was a whale, a dead whale that we figured out from its length was a juvenile, so a year old, a humpback whale that was severely entangled with ropes and creel pots around its tail, possibly dead for a week. And it was just, at the time, again, we were so laser focused on we need to tell the story. So we filmed everything. We filmed pieces to camera. I was, you know, we managed to stay very, very focused and did our job and filmed everything. And it felt like this real adrenaline moment. And James kept saying, there's a reason it's us that's found it. There's a reason it's us that's found it. We've got filming equipment. We can tell the story. There's a reason it's us. And he was just so focused on making sure that we did a good job of capturing everything. And I was so focused on making sure that I did all the pieces to camera that I needed to do to explain what was going on. And then, you know, we got back to land, reported it to all the relevant agencies, did everything that we needed to do, having found that dead animal. And then I just absolutely crashed. I was just devastated. I had, you know, a couple of days of just, I was really tearful and just felt really upset that the first humpback whale I'd ever seen was a dead baby. And actually, after the first couple of days of just feeling really, really gutted, it took me on quite a deep dive into marine mammal entanglement. And in the second episode of Scotland Ocean Nation, you know, we meet various different types of fishermen and we talk about the different types of fishing. And this was another kind of consequence of fishing that I'd heard about, but never in my wildest nightmares could ever have imagined that I would come across it myself. And so it really brought it home to me how significant marine mammal entanglement is in the UK and, you know, globally. And a lot of this stuff goes unseen. That's the issue. So in some ways, I'm really glad that we did find it so that we could bring it to the public's attention. But yeah, like I say, it brought me in a really deep dive of looking into what we can do about marine mammal entanglement. We went and spoke to lots of experts, not just the ones that you see in the film. We actually interviewed four or five different groups and different people about marine mammal entanglement and tried to get all the most relevant information about it. And it's made me feel a lot more passionate about solving this issue, because this is solvable and it's not something that should be happening in our waters now in the 21st century. You know, these are such important creatures, and yet these animals are getting wrapped up in static gear, in creel pots, in ropes. And so I'm still in touch with quite a few of the groups who are working towards reducing that incident by various technologies and what have you. So yeah, a lot to learn, definitely.
Yeah, and you know, as you say, out of sight, out of mind. And there are so many of those themes that you cover during those three episodes. And you know, I think, you know, where you've sort of delivered it so well is that, you know, the pace of the episodes are really well weighted, so that you know, you can see in the edit there's absolutely no gaps there. You sort of you spend as much time as required on the various different subjects. And I think, you know, by showing rather than telling, I think that's a hugely effective way of getting a environmental message over, because, you know, I think the tell and do approach generally doesn't go across very well, and it doesn't necessarily engage. I just wondered about the sort of environmental messages that you give. Was that a conscious decision to follow that sort of show rather than tell approach?
Yeah, definitely. We wanted people to feel like they were coming on a journey with us, that they were a part of it. And I think there's no better way of doing that than it's really hard to do, but letting yourself be like completely vulnerable to whatever's going to happen and allowing people to come along with you. That's kind of that's the whole point of the paddling mission, was to kind of get people on board, pardon the pun, and hopefully they could feel like they were a part of it as well. So I totally agree with you. I think people really need to kind of find their own unique way of connecting to the messages. So, you know, I could stand up and talk to people for an hour about marine mammal entanglement, but if they see it with their own eyes, they're going to feel very, very differently about it. Mm. And hopefully the films go some way to doing that. They go some way to kind of opening people's eyes to what's going on, to helping them experience the absolute majesty of our ocean underwater, above water. But I do think that there's no substitute for actually getting people there in person, which is, of course, what we do with our charity Seafall, which is all about helping more people to feel connected to the ocean, predominantly by actually taking them there and actually getting them underwater, snorkeling, or getting them paddleboarding, getting them seeing for themselves what's going on there. And the very last part of the last episode of Scotland Ocean Nation, we take a group of kids with our charity from Glasgow to the Isle of Arran to go snorkeling, and just seeing their faces light up when they see what's underwater is so mind blowing.
That bit's quite amazing. So the inner city kids, I know that one in five children in the UK have never been to the sea. So obviously there's a whole mission there, but that day looked a little bit cold. The wind probably whipping off the sea. I mean, it wasn't tropical waters that you were swimming in there, and they all loved it, didn't they? In fact, one of them said it was the best day of their life, which is always a double thumbs up, isn't it? Was that what you were expecting?
Not at all. I was so nervous that day. I was so nervous because it was freezing cold. And it wasn't the best weather. And these kids had never been snorkeling in Scotland before. And we were going to throw them in the sea. And I'd been in to check the site a bit before. And granted, I have had the great privilege of snorkeling and scuba diving some of the most amazing spots in the whole world. But this little part of Lamlash Bay, there wasn't that much to see. I didn't think there was that much of them to see. So I was really worried that they weren't going to find it that exciting. And honestly, we couldn't. So we planned to put them in the sea. We had two different groups. We planned to get them in for 20 minutes at a time. And we, after about an hour and a bit, we couldn't get them out. We were having to drag them out. We were going to miss the bus back to the ferry. They were so enthralled by what they were finding, like tiny little hermit crabs, bits of seaweed, like tiny fish, everything to them, because it was new and because they had no idea it was there. It was so special. And so it went from this day where I was like, I'm going to have to plan loads of stuff and loads of chat and, you know, keep them entertained, to literally all they needed was to be in the sea. And I didn't have to do anything other than just support that. And it was really eye-opening to me to just kind of, first of all, to acknowledge my own privilege that I get to do that whenever I want. And that for me, that is totally normal. And second of all, just how powerful it is for people to actually see what's underwater, to actually be in the sea and to experience it for themselves.
I mean, it's hugely powerful. And there was one of the little stars there who actually got the message herself at the end. You know, she was really clear about the fact that there are all these vulnerable creatures and you don't get to see them, and that we as humans have a obligation to protect them. I mean, that was, she was completely on message there.
Yeah, definitely. That honestly, that moment when she said that, was it just felt like we've done our job, and it just felt like this is exactly what we want to do. And actually, it's not that complicated. It's just that we have the great privilege of being there and spending time there, and these kids maybe haven't before. But all you need to do is show them, and the compassion for that place comes out. So, it was really special.
I mean, you know, there's so much to cover, and obviously we're not going to, you know, even remotely do it justice in this chat, but we've run for an hour. Have you got a bit more time?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Is that all right? Fantastic.
My tea's still lukewarm.
Excellent. Good stuff. Okay. As long as it's still liquid, that's fine. So, the other key theme there is about the marine environment and the marine ecosystem. And, you know, I would classify myself as someone who spent a, you know, decent amount of time on the water and has, I would say, a moderate amount of knowledge, but there was a huge amount of learning in there. And one of the other messages that you really reinforced in there is the practical benefits of a well-functioning marine ecosystem. And just from practical terms, from a sort of existence point of view, we know that the marine environment ties up carbon, but I was surprised about how much oxygen it produces for us to breathe. So every second breath we take is oxygen produced by the ocean. And obviously one of the main points you make is it simply won't do that if the environment continues to be compromised in the way that it's being damaged at the moment.
Yeah, quite right. And I think that's one of the things that is often forgotten about, especially in the year that I was paddling, which was the year that Glasgow was hosting COP26. And there was all this chat about terrestrial forests and climate change and X, Y, and Z and climate. And there was so little focus on the ocean, which covers 70% of our planet, and biodiversity and nature and their roles in the climate crisis. And actually, the ocean has a massive part to play in our lives, even if we don't paddleboard, even if we don't go snorkeling. Produces our oxygen. It's already absorbed a quarter of our anthropogenic carbon emissions. So that's carbon that's been created by man. Has a massive capacity to capture and store carbon, not just in its plants like its seagrass and its kelp, but also in its massive marine mammals like whales, which you can only imagine how much carbon a whale stores over its lifetime, and then sinks to the bottom of the sea where the carbon's stored. You've got massive areas of muds which store loads of carbon, and then, you know, it has all these other roles that it plays in our human lives. And I find it sad to think that we have to think about the ocean in terms of what we can get from it, but I think so often that's the way that humanity seems to be working at the minute. And it's irreplaceable. The services that the ocean provides are irreplaceable and vitally important to every single person's life on this planet. And that's a message I really wanted to get across, that, you know, this show and this ocean isn't just for those of us who really like to, you know, mess about there and, you know, hippies like me who like to go and snorkel or whatever. It's for everybody. And we all therefore have a responsibility and a right to stand up for its protection, not just those who want to use it for extractive means or for enjoyment. It's there for every single person. And I think it's starting to come across in some of the narrative from like the UN conferences and stuff. But, you know, we haven't got unlimited space on land to plant forests, but there's so much ocean where if we protected it, we'd have incredible biodiverse ecosystems that could store our carbon and support livelihoods and, yeah.
Yeah, and you're right, it's the land versus the sea. So one of the things, again, that I was unaware of is some legislation which was relaxed back in the 1980s, which allowed trawlers and dredgers to be able to operate within 3 miles of the coastline. And that's the spawning ground of fish. And when you see the amount of damage that it actually does, I mean, it's a bit like on land if you were, say, bulldozing a forest to try and harvest truffles. It's that totally destructive. But because it's hidden, you don't see it, and there's no one who actually owns the seabed, it all happens invisibly. But the amount of damage that it provides, it ends up sort of denuding fish stocks. So, you know, I'm just interested. You might not know the answer to this, but for me, that seems to be one of the big changes in recent years, which has had such a catastrophic effect on the marine ecosystem. Do you know if there's any sort of campaigning or progress to try and reestablish that limit? I know that there are some protected zones.
Absolutely. So this is basically until the 1980s, around the whole of the coast of Scotland, we're not talking UK now, we're talking Scotland specifically, there was the 3 miles within land of all of Scotland was off limits to dredgers, to trawlers. Now, trawlers, fishing with a trawl is basically dragging a heavy net across the seabed, and it's normally for prawns in Scotland, langoustine. In the 1980s, the fishing on the outside of those 3 miles had been basically outfished. So they petitioned the government to let them inside 3 miles. They were allowed inside 3 miles. And since then, that has led to the collapse of many, many fish stocks around the coast of Scotland, because like you quite rightly said, those areas within the 3 miles of coast are often quite shallow and often quite fragile. And that's where you get a lot of nurseries. You get where you get the flame shells. That's where you get things like merl, which is Scotland's coral reef. You get kelp and plants growing. And those fragile seabed areas, since the dredgers and trawlers have been allowed within those 3 miles, have been completely destroyed, or almost completely destroyed. Sorry, not completely destroyed, but almost. They've been really degraded, let's say that. They've been really, really badly damaged. What that's meant is we've seen a collapse in fish stocks and in livelihoods for many people who relied on the sea. And there's a coalition of over 100 members around, 100 organisations around the coast of Scotland who are petitioning for that 3 mile limit to be brought back in. And they've been petitioning for a few years. The campaign is called Our Seas, and the website is ourseas.scot. And you can go there and you can put your name to the petition. You can learn more about it. There's a really short film that you can learn more about the 3 mile limit. But that is, if that was reintroduced, that would instantly cover the Scottish government's ambition to protect 30% of waters by 2030. It would protect fish stocks. It would have a massive impact on, a positive impact on the biodiversity and the health of the ocean, both within those 3 miles and outside of the 3 miles, because it would have a spillover effect. I think from my personal point of view, I definitely think that the seas around Scotland need to be better managed. At the minute, they are so poorly managed. And I think that there needs to be more consideration for the impact that lots of different types of fishing has on the marine environment, not just trawling and dredging, but also, like we talked about, entanglement by creel gear. I don't think that the answer is to ban trawling and just allow creeling, which is the static pots, without any kind of limit on creel numbers, because that's not going to have a great result for cetaceans, for whales and dolphins. So it's really complicated, and through the 3 episodes of our series, we really tried to get across a little bit of that information and to try and help people to understand what the different types of fishing are, what the impacts are, and what can be potentially done about it, because it is really complicated, but it's also not complicated, if that makes sense. Like it's complicated in that people don't really tend to know about it, but also it's
some easy wins there. And certainly you bring the focus on. So, Cal, I'm 3 pages into my notes here, and I think I'm probably going to have to discard most of the other 7 here. But just in terms of your plans for this, obviously it's on Scottish TV, STV, and as I said, we'll link to all of the details in the show notes. What are the plans? I mean, how do we get it out in front of more people? Is Scottish TV going to give it a network showing? Is it going to be expanded through to the ITV network? I can see this as being required viewing for schools. What are the plans to sort of get in front of more eyes?
So at the minute, it's only available on the STV player, which is available UK-wide. So it's not just in Scotland. We just at the minute, that's the only place it's available, but we are working with other broadcasters around the world to try and get it available in other places as well. It would have been so much easier to make this film for YouTube. It would have been a doddle. It would have taken us a quarter of the time to have made this series for YouTube. But the whole point of making it for telly was that we wanted it to reach outside of the echo chamber that I currently talk within. And so that's why we went down that route. And we're really delighted that it's gone onto a Scottish broadcaster as well, because I think it gives Scottish people a sense of ownership of their waters. So who knows at this point in time? We're hoping that people continue to watch it on STV. They're doing a push on the network, on the linear channel, on the telly channel, in May, to try and get more people watching it on the player, but not quite sure at the minute. So we'll just have to kind of watch this space for the moment.
So it's available to the end of March next year.
Yes.
And as you said, you download the STV app anywhere in the UK. Now, I did notice you do have to put in a Scottish postcode in there. So I put my granny's in.
You have to put in a Scottish postcode.
Didn't you?
I registered with my postcode here.
There you go. Okay, so if you do, then I'm sure you can find a postcode somewhere in Scotland to input in that. And if you live outside the UK, VPN, just saying on that one. But I would certainly really highly recommend it because it's truly a stunning experience and a must-see for any paddleboarders or water lovers, wherever you are. And as I said, you know, we talked about some of the quite serious issues that are raised there, but ultimately it is a celebration of the ocean. You know, we haven't even talked about some of the people who you met there, including Nick, who looked like quite a character there. I think like everyone, we get a huge physical and mental boost from being on the ocean, being next to water. And I think that's something, regardless of your flavour of water activity, is something that we all share. So hopefully the SUP community can get behind this. The more eyeballs, the better, I think, in terms of sharing it more widely. And you don't have to be a paddleboarder to really get something from this. So, Cal, it's been a real privilege to be able to speak to you and also to share in your adventure. Thanks so much for joining us on SUP FM and see you on the water.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you supporting this, and it's great to speak to you again. And definitely next time, can we do it on paddleboards, please? Can we go for a paddle and have a chat then?
Definitely. Sounds good.